So this is when we get to have some more conversation, which is amazing. And I, it started out there with, among some food. So I wanted to just make one point that I realized I didn't quite get to maybe spur some of this conversation about counsel. And that is that shifting modes, really also pushes us outside of the win-lose mentality, right? So, it's not about who wins the argument, who gets the most votes. You know, it's, you know, it doesn't end up being 9-1 or 5-4, or it pushes us outside of that sort of Robert's Rules of Order mode into something that really requires us to give up that idea of winners and losers. And maybe it's the universalist in me that remember that statement, wherever we're going, we're all going there together. And so if we don't all win, nobody wins, right? That's the collective liberation piece. There is no individual liberation without collective liberation, at least as far as I'm concerned. And so this thinking about counsel and thinking about how power and authority is wielded, it has to shift us into that collective liberation mode, that we look for a decision where everyone benefits. And it's not about who wins and who loses. And that is also very countercultural these days. So with that last little point, we'll open it up. If people have questions, I want to pull up pieces from the two chapters. Come on up.
Julie, I was sitting there wondering how we could apply that to this little microcosm group right here, Word and Life. How could we make it even better than it is now as far as ownership? And I was thinking during the break, one way that people have shown ownership is that food table. People are owning it because every week somebody brings food for the table, and so that is one way of ownership. And there's eight of us that read a bunch of books, and we come up with the book. I wonder if there's any way we could have a group little discussion about how the Word and Life ownership could be expanded, or is it okay, or anybody have any comments about applying this, not exactly moral leadership, but ownership, counsel.
So there's one of the ways that counsel can be used, that I've seen it used, is not so much as the everyday decision-making, which book are we going to read, which speakers are we going to invite, who's going to be the point person for the coffee, right? That's kind of more on the mechanics type of conversation. But every now and then, being summoned to counsel as a community, where you put a big question in the middle, and then everybody gets their turn to say. And then the leadership group, because you do have to have leadership groups. I'm not talking about council being an entirely flat system, right? It is sometimes effective to have a group of people take that wisdom from a larger group and distill it down into a path forward. And so it sounds like this group has a sort of a steering committee that distills the wisdom of the group into deciding which books and which speakers. So maybe there's a time to summon a council for Word and Life. Put a big question in the middle. What is alive? What are you wrestling with in the world right now? Everybody gets to talk about it. And then the leadership group then can take that and do its book discernment or speaker discernment, having heard from the wisdom of the group. So the group isn't trying to make the tiny decisions together, because that way lies madness sometimes. Right? If you've been tried to like write bylaws in a group of 150 people, doesn't work. Right? So those details, word choices, book choices, speaker arrangements, scheduling, that's okay to hand off to a steering committee. But these big questions, those are places where counsel can be really effective. So I offer that up as an option. When you come to a point where there's some big discernment, direction setting to go, a vision for the next year, a question that emerges from group wisdom, maybe everybody needs to be summoned to counsel for that kind of conversation.
I wouldn't recommend this for Word and Life, but I thought I'd throw out how this church runs itself. The whole congregation elects elders. Elders serve on a council. But they only serve for 3 years, and every year a third of them gets replaced. So there's this constant turnover of ideas. And on the subject of moral authority, and I'm still wrestling with that term, but I was commenting on the break. I was a part of a team that did a mission study for this church just recently. And one of the things I discovered, there's over two dozen groups like Word and Life using this facility, and their needs have to be taken into consideration.
It's amazing how much this concept can impact things like when you need new chairs, what kind of chairs should you purchase? You know, I think about things like accessibility and who's not in the room and why are they not in the room? And maybe there's hidden barriers that we are not seeing because we're in the room. It's all working for us. If it wasn't working for us, we wouldn't be here. And so then we can make that logical leap to then, well, it works for everybody who wants to be here, and not being aware of the barriers that are keeping some people out who could benefit, who would love to be here, but can't for some reason. And so it's worthwhile bringing in, you know, that rotational leadership, however it is that you get, you know, a rotation of new perspectives so that you can start to see things and understand things that maybe were outside of your experience and let inform then your choices going forward. Other thoughts on counsel or ways you see counsel either having been used, maybe you have some experiences in your life where you've encountered this, or a place where you think, boy, wish we could do some of that, at the hospital, for example.
You know, I've just been thinking about our country.
You're not alone.
and some of this, you know, when you look at governments over historical times, they all fall. They fail for some reason or another. And you kind of wonder, like, where are we going? Like, when, you know, we look like we're getting kind of close to failing. And one of the things is we have a lot of corporate, you know, we've grown a lot because we've done a lot of different things as a democracy. Part of the reason I think we've grown so much is because we've had more input. You know, it's not just what the king says or, you know, this ruling family, but we've now gotten into this little picky pile of everybody's fighting with everybody else. And I noticed that some corporations were actually kind of thinking about this, like the economic welfare or the definer of the economic thing of a corporation was how much you pay your stockholders. If they're happy, it's a good corporation. Now some of them are starting to think, I like the term maybe in the larger world of stakeholders. Mm-hmm. So who are the stakeholders, which in a way has a sense, that sense. So like if you're bringing a gas line through, and, you know, you're Native Americans and that's your water supply, you know, that's, you're a stakeholder. Well, if there's ways that we could talk about this, maybe we could just learn to talk about it in a larger, and put that into the larger context, because I think America could stand as a democracy if we could learn to talk about this in larger ways.
About that everybody's voice being heard, and how does that happen right in a democracy?
And a suggestion, well, something that I heard recently on, I heard it on NPR, maybe some of you heard it. This man had written a book about why Rome fell and what happened after Rome fell. And he said what happened was Rome fell, and then there were all these little European principalities and whatever. And because there were so many different ones, they all had different ideas and they did different things. And the ones that were along the ocean got out and they got in their boats and they sailed around. And they sold, and you know, and so Europe grew up as a really kind of strong thing because there was no central authority saying, you can't do that, you can't do that, you can't do that. He said, maybe that's what'll happen, you know. Our governor has said, oh, we're California, we're going to do it this way. And some other states are doing it too. So it was like, well, that could be an okay way if we had to fall apart. They said, we know that a central government, you know, that would be better, but we don't have it. Anyway, in smaller groups, we can have those conversations.
So that's this is an interesting pointer in terms of council, because the council practice is, of course, very much part of indigenous communities' organizational structures a lot of times. So you read the Rule of St. Benedict, 500 or so, this emerging in a monastic tradition, this concept of council. And then you've also got concept of councils emerging in other cultures, in other traditions, in other languages, including in a lot of the indigenous cultures here in the United States, which is where I first encountered it, right? So going to Standing Rock for the demonstration against the pipeline and seeing how council held that space and what council did, I mean, there it was an intense spiritual feeling of a container that held that resistance. And it was held by the elders explicitly, and it was held in council all the time, sitting and thinking and talking together. And I entered into that space as a guest, as an ally, and in solidarity. But you could feel when you walked into the camp that there were some other ways of being in this space that were not the ways I was used to being. And I had to really pay a lot of attention so that I could start to see things and understand ways of operating that were not the ways that I was used to operating. And this idea of council, and it overlaps with this whole decentralization. One of the things when colonialism took root in the United States, and when the United States government was trying to figure out how to negotiate the treaties that were worthless eventually, but it was very frustrating because they wanted a representative from the indigenous community, from the tribe, that had authority on behalf of the tribe to make the decisions, and they wanted that representative to meet with the representative of the United States government, negotiate the treaty, and then everybody would obey. That's not how council works, and that's not how the authority structures of indigenous communities work, right? So there was no one person who could speak for the tribe. There's a council process. And that person couldn't come back and say, well, I negotiated this treaty and this is how it's going to be, folks. Because if folks didn't agree, they would just say, nope, that's not how it's going to be. And go ahead with the process that the council... And the government of the United States had no idea how to navigate this relationship between these two sovereign entities. And so what ended up happening was the government then just picked people randomly to be the representative, sign the paper, and say, well, that's a treaty. And the indigenous community said, wait, that person doesn't represent us. And the U.S. government said, no, they're your representative now. So you ended up with these dual power structures. You had a point, and this is all the way into the 20th century and 21st century, right? So we do some work in the Hopi and Navajo reservations. And the tribal councils that we think of as tribal government is an imposed from the outside, is an organizational system imposed from the outside to create a point of contact between our governmental structure and tribal governmental structure. That tribal council may or may not have situational authority. And so then you end up with some really thorny problems of how do you discern decision-making, because you've got competing structures of authority, one that's an internal, organic, historical structure, and then this imposed structure to try to interface with an external government that has not worked. So that it's interesting to see how when council is a mode, you have to pay a lot of attention between that intersection, that boundary between the council and the way people are used to working. Because people will do everything they can to circumvent the power of council-based decision-making if it doesn't go along with profit or the shareholder value, or if the powers that be disagree with the decision that comes out of council. They will work very hard to try to disrupt the power and authority that is garnered through council.
So that's what I was thinking, that the council meets, you gather people, many voices, but it has to be ongoing. There have to be correctives. Otherwise, you know, all this advice goes out, and then the people who are the leaders try to carry it out, can't, are... You know, and then it falls apart. So kind of how have you managed that in your congregation? Just to know.
So that's right, the reciprocity of relationship, right? So in our congregational structure, we have a board of trustees that makes decisions on behalf, that is sort of the vision, mission holder for the congregation. As minister, I'm on the sort of more operational side, right? I'm the person who helps implement and carry out the vision and mission of the congregation, the work of the congregation. And then the board, there's moral ownership, but then there's also this piece they call linkage, right? So this is kind of coming in from some nonprofit organizational structures, but the linkage is how that works. The board is tasked with maintaining their sense of the larger community. They have to actively come up with ways to constantly be checking back in with the congregation as a whole. And there's a lot of ways a board or a leadership group can do this. Hold town hall meetings where they put the question out and get feedback. They can do surveys. They can have informal conversations. They can talk with the leaders of different groups and committees, right? So you don't want to just have one way. We have an annual meeting. That's one place. But it can't be the only place. So if you have a group of people who are in a leadership capacity or trying to implement the work that is, or the vision that is established through a council process, that group of people have to be intentionally linking always back to that larger body in various ways. Otherwise, they do end up either way over here and everybody's like, wait a minute, that's not what we're talking about. Or it just kind of can break down and you lose the investment, you lose the collaboration and the buy-in from everybody.
I was curious, as a minister of your congregation, how much do you cast a vision and how much do you implement the council's vision? What's that balance for you?
It's ongoing and it is a dynamic balance, I would say, right? So anybody who's worked with clergy know that sometimes we have a lot of ideas and a lot of opinions. It's endemic to the job. It's not a bad thing. But it is partially my job to help cast a vision, to be inspiring from the pulpit, or to help the community figure out where and how it's going and how we're going to get there. But if I go running off in a direction without looking behind me, and then you turn around, where is everybody? Right? So it's a relationship. The board of trustees, I'm accountable to them, right? And so if I start running off in a direction, the board can kind of say, hey, wait, come here and let's talk about this before you get too far out there and let's figure out where we're going. And so it is, there's a shared, I think of it as a shared ministry between me and the congregation and the leadership of the congregation. And it's a relationship that has to be tended to and cared for, and you have to have ways of dealing with conflict. And ways to resolve disagreements that are healthy. It doesn't mean conflict is unhealthy. That's what I also love about the rule of St. Benedict. It doesn't try to shove conflict off into the bad category. You have to have processes for keeping engaged. And you do those gut checks, right? So I have colleagues who find themselves at odds with the congregations that they serve. And at some point you have to be willing to say, you know what, I don't think we're a good fit anymore. Because your vision and my vision are not in a healthy, dynamic, productive tension. We're in a conflict that I don't think can be resolved, right? And so you have to have the maturity. Both the congregation has to have the maturity and the clergy have to have the maturity to know when the gap is too big. And you have to respect each other's freedom and respect each other's intelligence and capabilities, right? So there's a freedom of the pulpit in Unitarian Universalist tradition. I can preach whatever I am called to preach. That's the freedom of the pulpit. And it's paired with the freedom of the pews, right? You don't have to agree with me. And there's some interesting conversations that come after Sunday mornings because of that. We also were talking, I want to kind of open up to, we've been talking a lot about council. There's also that concept of fault that was in that first chapter. So I want to kind of throw that out there too, but come on up.
Yeah, for 6 years we lived in Washington, D.C. and worked with leaders in Congress. And you don't need to know why, but what I saw there is no rest. And because there is a lack of rest, they are making decisions on the fly, they go home every weekend, which didn't used to happen, but to be connected to their areas, you know, their districts, they have to fly home. And sometimes that's to Hawaii, to California, you know, and it's an interesting dilemma because I think also we see the outflow of what a culture without rest does. Yeah. So it's. I don't know if you have any comments about that.
I mean, what a fascinating lens to look at the current situation through. To watch the news and ask yourself the question, what would it look like if everybody involved in this situation had gotten 9 hours of sleep last night?
Yeah.
How would this be different? What would this current situation look like if people had a true vacation of more than 3 days in a row in the past year? Would we be in a radically different place? This is really important as spiritual communities that are our task as spiritual communities is to help ground our civic life in something bigger than the next 24-hour news cycle, right? So we can be proponents of the Sabbath. We can be proponents of rest and contemplation. We can be proponents of fair labor practices that give people paid vacation to take rest. We can be proponents. So there's both individual responsibility for saying, I need to get some sleep. I need to make sure the people around me get some sleep or rest or vacation. And then there's social components that we have to keep an eye out for what's driving us and how do we use our influence to help create a social structure that gives us breathing space, please, so that we can make good, wise decisions. That's a really fascinating thing to think about.
Thank you for coming and being so inspiring. One of the things I thought about as you were talking was how we can bring some of the practices we've learned here into those situations where there is a lot of agitation and anxiety. So when we meet with the sheriff's representatives or the commanders and so on, we've just begun the practice of starting our meetings with breathing and just saying, hey, we've learned that this is a way to reach the wisdom part of our brain. So, you know, usually you think, well, this is a public meeting, now we do it that way. And then we do our clue meetings, for example, the other way. But to bring those together, I think, could be a strategy and a practice that could slow things down and help us reach a kind of a human common place from which we can solve very difficult problems and systems changes.
I thought I would share something that I just remembered, and I happen to have this card on me. The importance of that moment, taking a moment. I take a class in adult ed, and we had a team, husband and wife, come and make a presentation on their organization, Freedom to Choose Foundation, and they work with prisoners. And they form groups that help the prisoners learn to take that moment. And it's all based on Viktor Frankl's statement, and I'll read it. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is the power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. And this, these groups he has put together has made a fundamental difference in the life of the prisoners, where they no longer just react and they take that moment to let the mind rest and see another alternative. So anyway, I wanted to choose it.
That's beautiful. Between the stimulus and the response, that breath that is necessary to find wisdom. See the clock there, so I want to check on the time. 10 minutes? All right. So if you were going to kind of zoom out into this conversation around fault, I'm starting to see, you know, everything is interconnected, right? that's one of the Unitarian principles, the interdependent web, right? So where do those two things in conversation with each other? Where are these two chapters in conversation, right? So we talked about fault and honesty and the ability to be both good and flawed and the need to find a space to process those places where we've missed the mark. And then we've talked about this process of counsel, right? Where do you see some intersections between these two chapters? Between personal and political, perhaps? Parenting. Hold that thought. We've got somebody coming with the mic, but then we can talk about family and parenting relationships.
Sometimes when I'm feeling most like self-righteous and critical about somebody, usually, I start to get this little voice like maybe I am protesting too much, and you know, and I really have to step back and recognize that there's certainly another side, and there's no reason to be so critical of someone. Then there may be something I don't know, and anyway, just I do see a connection between those two things. So
that's like that humility piece that comes with being able to recognize our imperfections, right? Having some humility in the counsel process and in the seeking change process, we have to bring that with us. Yeah. Christine, did you? Christine was throwing out there the concept of how does this relate to parenting? And I throw that out there because whether or not you have kids, you have been parented, whether or not you have parented someone else. So that's an interesting conversation, something that lives very close to our hearts.
So in response to your question, there's pretty much every week I keep coming back to two terms, and you just used one of them is what this book and about the rule of Benedict is. One is listen, and the other is humility. So that's where I see the connection between these two chapters and perhaps running throughout all of the chapters is I think we have trouble listening. Well, I know we have trouble listening. I know I have trouble listening anyway. We're so often, what's the old saying? You're spending more time formulating a response than you are listening what the other person has to say. And so, and I don't, in terms of from our national political process to family, are you truly listening? Are you listening to really hear what the person has to say? Are you using loving inquiry to draw out so you understand them as best as possible? So that whole failure to listen and ability to listen is a big issue. And then humility is not I don't have all the answers, but a lot of people seem to act as though they do. Some more than others. But those two, those are just two, and those two qualities speak to me. Am I truly listening, and am I truly humble?
Or as your grandmother used to tell you, you've got two ears and one mouth for a reason.
In my email yesterday, I saw this quote. It was from a scene in the stage adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird. And the judge says, people generally hear what they listen for and see what they're looking for. And that can lead to a lot of trouble.
Right. You see what you want to see and you hear what you want to hear, right? We filter things to fit our frame all the time, no matter where you fall in the political spectrum or where your personal experience, we have this very bad habit of doing that.
And that whole point of listening, if you think about the Benedictine, it's listening with the ear of the heart. And when you listen with your heart rather than your head, you don't filter those preconceived ideas and judgments. So you withdraw that judgment and you're open. And there's just so much wealth that can be gained from that little statement. And Viktor Frankl certainly, said it really well. But that pause allows us to just stop and really kind of hold that tension of opposites and sit with it. And when we do that, we lose our judgment and we become more tolerant. And then we're more open to the other point of view. So I always think of listen with your heart first.
So we're going to wrap it up, and I just want to make one last point that kind of came up in that conversation in between, and that, again, going back to this book and St. Benedict's experiences that led to this in monastic life, is that he wrote this in community. And so it's self-reflection in our world in Santa Barbara. We can spiral down into self-help and self-reflection very quickly into our own spiritual life as being its own little bubble, and we're about self-development and self-improvement, but that the wisdom that we're reading was generated not from somebody who lived alone, but from somebody who is deeply committed to community and to the betterment of the community, the monastic community, and the community of humanity. And so always challenging ourselves to think about, well, if I get this wisdom for myself, how do I live with integrity carrying that wisdom out into the world? So if I had one hope to give to ask of you all, is that the wisdom that you garner here and the wisdom that you garner from each other, you find ways to share it and to use it and to work with it like clay to make this world a more beloved place. And then I'll be happy. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for coming today and sharing with us. We look forward to seeing you in the future. So, that's it for today. We will be convening again, same time, same place, next week. Chapters 17 and 18, and Dr. She's got an extra syllable in there, I always miss. Winninger? Thank you, Don. Will be with us next week. Anyway, so go in peace.